Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. And we are happy to have back here on the program as our guest in this hour, Mae Barenbaum. She is an entomologist at the University of Illinois. That means she is a scientist who studies insects. She is, in fact, the head of the Department of Entomology and occasionally is on the program and we talk about bugs. Now, at the beginning here, I want to be very clear about something. This is not the kind of show that's designed to help you exterminate insects if you have problem insects in your home. We have a guy for that. Phil Nixon is his name, and he is also here occasionally on the show. And that's really his specialty, is although, amazingly enough, he's also much for coexistence. he's a guy that I think would right at the beginning say, well, now, wait a minute, how bad a thing is this? And if you really want to get rid of it, okay, I can tell you how to do that. Anyway, that's a entirely different sort of thing. When Mae is on the program, and we've been doing this for, I don't know, umpteen years.
Since 1982.
Since 1982, we do a different kind of show. And the idea here is to try to appreciate insects for how interesting they are and how varied they are and talk about how they go about living their lives. If there is some insect that you have seen lately that you're curious about, if you can call in and give us a description and give us the best that you can, Mae will see if she can, based on your description, tell you what that is and then tell you some things about it. Or if you have other kinds of general insect questions about their behaviors and so forth, you can call in here and I know she will do her best to give you an answer. All questions cannot be answered, of course, but I've seen her do an amazing job of doing this over the years. She's always kind of nervous about it. She's afraid someone's going to ask her a bunch of questions that she can't answer, but I really haven't seen that happen very often.
Well, there was that question about Andorran butterflies, never having set foot in Andorra or any place nearby, that was a tricky one.
But. Well, she's done really well over the years. And questions are invited. We'll put her to the test once again and see how she does. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, it's very nice to have you here.
Yeah. Always a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Just the other night, Mrs. Inge was standing out in the backyard, and she says that she saw a firefly. And I'm thinking, isn't that a little early for fireflies?
I had the same experience, and it is a little early for fireflies. Usually in this part of the world, it's toward the end of June, sort of reaching a peak right around the 4th of July, you know, very patriotic of them. But I've seen them here, too. So they're definitely on the early side. Generally, you see a lot of them if it's kind of wet. But this doesn't make a lot of sense because it hasn't been particularly wet. In fact, there was talk of an impending drought. So the wetness is because in their larval stages, the immature stages, the fireflies feed on, most fireflies feed on, slugs and the like. So when it's when conditions are favorable for slugs and snails, it's also favorable for fireflies.
Mm. So because it's been dry, then it might overall it might not be a very good firefly year this year. Or is there any way to know?
It's really hard to predict. I mean, well, imagine the difficulties that meteorologists have predicting the weather. Well, that's compounded. You have to predict the responses of thousands of different species to weather conditions, and then there's even local variation of weather conditions, which makes it even harder. So hard to pin down an entomologist. So.
Well, I guess I suppose we have tried to do that over time.
It's very easy to pin down the insects, but not the entomologist.
The other day I heard about somebody collecting insects. I don't know if this was just sort of metaphorical or if this is true, mentioning that one of the insects they had collected were mosquitoes and that they had pinned them like we see insects pin. And I'm thinking, how did mosquitoes are so small. How could you possibly pin a mosquito to anything?
Well, there are all kinds of strategies for mounting tiny, fragile, insubstantial insects. And, you know, when it's not very practical to put a pin directly through the body, there's a set of pins called Minuten pins, like minute. Mm-hmm. And they are teeny tiny pins, and you put them into a little piece of polyporous fungus and then put the fungus on the – it's like a little – just looks like a maybe looks like styrofoam, and then you put the pin through the styrofoam. There's also something called pointing, where you punch out little triangles or sort of teardrop-shaped pieces of paper and then basically paste or glue the insect onto the point. So that's pointing. So all kinds of techniques for handling. And then when they're really, really small and very soft-bodied, you just put them on a slide. You don't pin them at all. Aphids, you don't. You couldn't really put a pin through an aphid.
I guess not. This work must require a very steady hand.
And not easy with bifocals either.
And do people still do that? Collect insects in that way?
There's
put them in big trays and arrange them in...
We got about 7 million of them here at the Illinois Natural History Survey. So not all on pins, but the vast majority. So. Mm-hmm. I think it's the 7th or 8th largest insect collection in North America. So something... Not the tourists don't flock here for that reason, but I thought maybe a billboard or two on the I-57 coming into town maybe could direct some tourism our way.
Well, if you need to get the local Chamber of Commerce interested in this and get them in to put you in the brochure.
Yeah, and it tends to be that counties that have land grant universities tend to have much higher insect diversity than other counties, and it's not so much biological; it's just that the people who can put names on things are there.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here, someone on a cell phone. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. I just want to weigh in on the firefly issue. I've noticed them the past couple of years in May, but they have more of a greenish glow, and in the later ones seem like they have more yellow glow. So I'm going to go ahead and hang up and see what you have to say. Thanks.
All right. Do you find a difference in the color according to species or according to when you see them or...
Well, when you see them is often a function of species because species will have different life cycles and periods of abundance and the like. I haven't noticed a seasonal variation in color around here, not out of the realm of possibility, but there's certainly a lot of variation in firefly color, so-called bioluminescence. The way the species specificity works for the fireflies, that this is a signaling system where males and females try to locate each other. It's one of the few signaling systems where sort of it's equal opportunity, males and females flash. Because crickets, only the males chirp, cicadas, only the males sing. So I like to think fireflies are a little more advanced in the courtship range of things. So it's not so much the wavelength, but the frequency of the flash. So each species has a species-specific flash pattern. So females usually hang around low in the vegetation, and males are the ones you see flying back and forth signaling. So they'll go back and forth sort of flashing their recognition signals, and then when they're satisfied that they've found the one, then they'll come turn off the lights for a little privacy. But here, we have sort of either yellowish or greenish, but there are other species that are much more elaborate. And in fact, in Malaysia, there's some famous fireflies that flash synchronously. So across a wide geographic range, they'll all flash simultaneously, on, off, on, off. So it's just like a sort of a neon sign. And they're not the only ones that are bioluminescent. There's click beetles that flash, and they get even flashier in terms of color. There's one called the railroad worm in Central and South America that has three different colored lights, green lights, red lights, and orange lights. So rather garish, I guess.
And how do they employ these? Is it the same sort of thing? Is certain patterns of flash mean certain sorts of things, or different ones have different...
No, it's just one display. Oh. But, people might wonder how it is that the fireflies can afford to go advertising themselves when there's certainly lots of things at night that can eat insects. Because generally anything that you can see and is conspicuous, and if you catch it, is very sluggish and slow-moving, it means it's poisonous. So don't eat fireflies. They contain a group of chemicals called leucobufagins, which are heart poisons and apparently extremely bad tasting. Mm-hmm. So don't eat them, and don't give them to your lizard to eat either, because they're not good for lizards.
So presumably then anything that might want to eat a firefly would learn after a couple, they'd say, this is terrible, and would never bother another firefly again.
That's the idea.
That's the idea.
Although some fireflies eat other fireflies. So.
Well, there is the famous femme fatale yes. firefly. Yeah.
And interestingly, that femme fatale firefly, not only for those who haven't heard this show before, the female femme fatale will flash to any male, irrespective of whether it's her species or not, because whatever isn't her species, she just eats. And the deal there is they don't even make their own poisons. They just get poisons from the ones they eat. So not only are they promiscuous, they're lazy too. So fortunately, there's no nobody's – one shouldn't be judgmental, I guess, about firefly lifestyles. We should be accepting of them all.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is a very broad-minded Mae Birnbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects and occasionally is on the program. That's what we talk about. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have some others. In fact, we have a bunch of people here. Let's go next to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, just wanted to mention something about firefly aesthetics. one of my early experiences when we moved here was we were out for an evening drive, and it was twilight, and we came up on, we were out in the country, and we came up upon a wheat field that was ripe. So it would have been, I think wheat seems to be harvested close to July 4th around here. And so the galt wheat was this silvery color in the twilight. And I forget whether there was a full moon coming up or not. But the fireflies started rising up out of this silvery field. And it was just magical to see it. And I really enjoy watching fireflies as the evening approaches and they start rising up out of the grass. It's just that, too, is somewhat magical, but not as magical as when it rises out of a ripe wheat field. And then I was looking at, I ran across a lovely book called Sunflower Houses. It's about gardens and gardening things to do with kids. And it's suggested as one possibility with fireflies is to take a hollyhock blossom on its stem, or maybe some other kind of long-petaled blossom, put the firefly in there, and then clamp the flowers closed so you have this little lantern to walk around with. Presumably you let the firefly loose, but I just thought that was rather, you know, kind of interesting. I've heard of, you know, putting fireflies in jars and so forth, but putting it in a hollyhock blossom and pinning the blossom closed just sounded even more magical. So I just thought we should share those things with you.
Well, you're not alone. In fact, in Japan, there's actually a festival that's the Firefly Watching Festival. I think Hotaru is, I think, the Japanese word for firefly. There's two insect-related festivals in Japan. Mushikiki is the festival of listening to the insects, and then there's a firefly festival in the summer. And I guess you're not alone in appreciating the aesthetics of the experience.
Oh, and I have one more question. I was pulling garlic mustard. This is garlic mustard pulling season. And, all spring has been, but the stuff is going to seed now. Anybody has garlic mustard in your yard? You probably do. It's going to seed now around here anyway, and it's better get it pulled before it spreads lots of seeds around and contributes to the seed reservoir that contributes to loss of native wildflowers in our woods. Sometimes I would see on the garlic mustard, I don't usually see any bugs on the garlic mustard, but I would repeatedly see, and I never had a jar to catch it, a little red beetle. It was about the size of a ladybug, but instead of having a roundish body like a ladybug does, the body was somewhat more oval, and two of the dots were in the middle of the body, symmetrically arranged, one on either side, and had a couple of other dots, but I was too busy collecting the garlic mustard to take a lot of time to focus on this little beetle. Does this sound like anything that comes to mind to you?
Well, it's interesting to hear that you find any insects, because garlic mustard, even though it belongs to the mustard family, the cruciferous family, of which there are many, many representatives in North America, including some introduced species from Europe, most of our crucifer eating insects avoid garlic mustard. Even the ones, even the European imports don't like it. Like the imported European cabbage worm or the cabbage white butterfly, they don't like garlic mustard. We have a couple of beetles, but they don't match your description. They're sort of elliptical in shape, but striped and not spotted. There's two species of flea beetles that are found on crucifers. But this is a new one on me. It should be of interest because people would, for a change, love to have insects that could eat something. So
it didn't look like it was doing anything
eating?
To the garlic
yeah.
mustard, although I did see and I brought back some diseased garlic mustard, some of which had deformed flower heads, and I found somebody here at the U of I who's garlic mustard researcher. I gave him the plants. It's supposedly, according to the garlic mustard biological control community on the web is such a wonderful thing. There's a virus that affects Brassicaceae, but it's not specific just to garlic mustard, and it doesn't really do the plant. But who knows? Yeah. I thought I would contribute to science by bringing the plant back. Maybe I have. Who knows? But anyway, we can all do something by pulling the dang stuff and keeping it from contributing to
our
woodlands. Thanks very much.
All right,
thank
thanks
you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, you never lack for a hobby. If you want to go after invasive weeds, you can be busy all year long.
Well, and this is one that it's easy to spot. Once you've seen it, you know what it is. And it's really invasive. And I think I have had that experience that, again, once you know what it is, then you start seeing it everywhere. And I think, as the caller says, it would be a good thing to yank. Certainly, if it's in your yard, yank it up and get rid of it, because it's really, really invasive plant.
Falls under the what were they thinking category when, you know, the European settlers brought stuff over, like poison hemlock, which, you know, sort of chokes the banks of the boneyard all through town and is makes toxic, neurotoxic alkaloids and smells like dead mice. And, okay, they brought this with them, and they planted it deliberately and cultivated it. So, all right.
Because it reminded them of home.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The home they fled. So, go figure.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Belgium. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
When I was a kid, about 8 years old, in our backyard, we had a small pond. And one evening, I fed this one frog. Well, there were frogs out back. I fed this one frog a firefly, and its stomach would blink. And I was just fascinated by that, because I was 7 or 8 years old. And when you mentioned that they were poisonous, now would that have killed that frog within a few days, or?
Highly likely. It kind of depends on how large the frog is and what kind of firefly it was, but they're pretty noxious.
Yeah.
But don't feel guilty about it.
No, this was eons ago.
Yeah.
Okay,
so,
that's it.
Oh, thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Are there any – now, you'd think, though, that the way things go, that there might well be something that is adapted to eating – it's being just fine eating fireflies.
Oh, that's is the – yeah.
Is there anything that will eat them?
Big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them, and other fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum. Everybody gets eaten. And as I mentioned, there are fireflies that eat other fireflies. So – and if it's not firefly – if it's not vertebrates that are eating them, it's highly likely that there are parasitic wasps that lay their eggs inside their eggs. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to make a living inside other insects, so, if you're an insect. So everybody's got somebody who eats them.
So. Okay. Indiana, line number 3.
Everybody eats
Hello.
Somebody sometimes.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey. A couple of comments, since you brought up the thing about hemlock. When I was younger and I saw those along the ravines, you know, I immediately went to them to look at them, because I was drawn in by the spherical flower shape.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in a sense, how the limbs, quote-unquote, projected out of the main stalk. So it may have just been an aesthetic thing as far as that. And then, of course, we got to remember they were Europeans, and Socrates is in there somewhere. So may have been something there. I have two questions, though. One, from the fields I was in before I retired, each year or ever so often, somebody would be awarded a prize of some sort for advancing the cause of that particular field. Of course, they do it in mathematics every year and physics also. I'm not talking at the Nobel Prize level, but, you know, at a peer group thing. I was wondering if the entomologists have that. And secondly, along with that, I was sort of wondering what's the driving goal now in people who'd be doing their dissertations in entomology. Is there a particular area that people want to know the answers to, and that's where a lot of graduate students are putting their energies?
Well, I have to thank you for asking. So rarely does anyone ever ask questions about entomologists or entomology. So, I mean, insects are of marginal interest to most people, but entomologists are even more on the periphery. So thank you very much for being interested in the field. And as you suspect, every scientific discipline has a way of patting itself on the back. And entomology, the Entomological Society of America has a number of awards for various sorts of sub-disciplines. There's the Entomological Society of America has what's called the Founders Award, and it's to recognize an outstanding entomologist who in turn acknowledges the contributions of a predecessor. So it kind of helps link the past to the present. And I think that's a really great idea because nowadays with a lot of web-based searches not going back beyond 10 years, it's as if there's, you know, there's no past at all. But in fact, we wouldn't be here if it weren't for the work of our predecessors. I can't remember whether, who was it that stood on the shoulders of giants? Was it, Newton? Yeah, I think it was Newton who said that he stood on the shoulders of giants. So.
Yeah.
And then there's awards for biochemistry, physiology, and toxicology. There's one award. And then there's another award for extension entomology. And just about every different way you can be an entomologist, you can win an award for it. So. And then what's hot in entomology? I think one sort of growth area is molecular entomology. There, the very first complex organism to be sequenced, where the whole genome, every single gene was characterized and sequenced, was an insect. It was Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly, the sort of workhorse of genetics. There's sort of a priority list that's coordinated centrally. The federal government sort of allocates money depending on the importance of various organisms. And I think it's a testament to the interest in insects that the sequence of the genome of the honeybee, Apis mellifera, was just recently completed, and it was completed before pigs and chickens. So that's how important honeybees are. That effort is being coordinated by our faculty in our department right here at University of Illinois. The sequencing was done down in Texas at Baylor, but Gene Robinson and Hugh Robertson are two of our faculty members who are sort of more or less responsible for assembling the genes and figuring out, well, leading the effort to assemble all these genes and figure out what makes up a honeybee. And there's just a recent announcement that two more insects are in line to be sequenced. There's an aphid, the pea aphid, that's going to be sequenced. And that's understanding that the genome of pea aphids will help to understand and give insights into ways to manage aphids, which are big economic pests, as everyone here in central Illinois knows when we got hit by the soybean aphid back in the year 2000. Which is every year since. And then the Rhodnius prolixus is another species that just was slated to be sequenced, and that's a blood-sucking true bug, a relative of the bed bug. So that's another one that's just on the, I can't say the chopping block, sequencing machine. So all kinds of genes. I mean, Drosophila melanogaster, it's a little tiny insect, has over almost 14,000 genes. So it's a big job to figure out what all the genes are and what they code for and how they interact. So that's a real growth area.
Can I ask another question, David?
Sure.
Since you brought it up, this might even be more interesting to the general population. How about saying something about honeybees and pollination and mites and good old man trying to kill certain animals that all, you know, sort of a focal point. I've read some rather, you know, alarming things from California that, the things they've done now are they're reaping what they've sowed. And in some sense, you know, I'd say that's the way life is. It's nature. You know, you shouldn't mess around with Mother Nature. But I wonder if you could say something about that, sort of bring things up to date and exactly what the, are we at the level where we may just lose the bee industry in this country?
Thanks well, a lot. That's a really excellent point. There's, when you say bee, everybody, there's thousands of species of bees, but when you say bee to most people, they think honeybee, which is this one species, Apis mellifera, and it's called the Western honeybee. It's not actually native to the U.S. It's from Europe, but it was brought over back in the 17th century by European settlers, along with their poison hemlock and everything else they brought. But the honeybee was brought over not only the fact that it can make pollen, it can make honey and wax, and we still use honeybees for making honey and wax, but because it is an extraordinarily gifted pollinator, whereas some of the native bees are very specialized and can only pollinate certain flowers in a narrow range of families of plants, like the squash bee pollinates plants in the squash family. Honeybees are sort of the ultimate generalists and are amazingly well equipped for adapting to all different sorts of flowers. So as a consequence, they've become absolutely vital to U.S. agriculture as pollinators. So if you add up everything honeybees pollinate, their contribution to the U.S. agricultural economy amounts to about $15 billion. Because not only do they pollinate many of the fruits, apples, pears, oranges, also vegetables such as the peppers and cucumbers and squashes and melons and onions and lettuce. It's very hard to think of plants. About one third of our diet comes from honeybee pollination, just honeybee pollination. So what's the problem? Well, over the last 20 years, honeybee populations have been in profound decline. At least in part because there have been two accidental introductions of parasites of honeybees. We were talking about everything gets eaten by somebody. In the case of honeybees, they're really prone. They live in these complex societies, big, 30,000 individuals in a single hive. So they're very prone to parasites, and there are two parasites, one called the tracheal mite that lives in the respiratory system of the bee, and the other called the varroa mite or the vampire mite. That feeds on the blood, actually, of bees when they're not in the adult stages but in the immature stages. And they have such a devastating impact on the colonies that you can almost not find wild or feral colonies anymore. Unless bees are protected or managed by people, they just can't make a go of it because they can't cope with these parasites. You mentioned California. California has a special relationship with honeybees because they grow some crops that simply cannot be produced without honeybees these days, like almonds. California, I believe, is the world producer of almonds. It's the leading producer of almonds in the world. And almond production in California depends on honeybees. And now it's gotten to the point where California honeybees can't pollinate. There are just not enough of them to pollinate the almond orchards. And their beekeepers are coming in from all across the country transporting their beehives just so that we'll have an almond crop. And that's a very high-value crop. And it's so they're particularly concerned about this honeybee decline in California. And, you know, lots of other things. There's the concern about African bees, the aggressive bees moving up from the south, making bees in general more difficult to manage. There's loss of honey subsidies. There's honey dumping by China and other nations that produce honey. So it's a tough row to hoe to be a beekeeper these days. And the numbers of beekeepers have been declining. So it's doesn't make headlines across the country, but it's certainly a cause for concern. In fact, one of my goals I'll never achieve is I always wanted to write a bad science fiction novel. And I thought a great plot would be if all the honeybees disappeared. But I just couldn't make it scary enough. You know, it's like, oh, geez, we'll lose all our vegetables. I don't think that would scare too many kids. Right? It doesn't really have a lot of science fiction film potential. But someday, look for my name on the, I don't know, in the discount bin or something.
Yeah.
But it would be pretty scary in reality if we lost our honeybees. Mm.
The honeybee was not native to the Americas.
Right.
I'm presuming that there were other bees.
Lots and lots of native bees.
Uh-huh. So what was there a particular impact on native bee populations when this introduced species, the European honeybee, was brought over by the European settlers?
Well, according to some people, honeybees themselves are invasive species in the sense that they have displaced or outcompeted a lot of native bees. But lately, those feral populations, the ones that are in direct competition with native bees, are just disappearing. You may have noticed in the last couple decades, if you pay attention to such things, that bumblebees seem to be a lot more common than they used to be. And that might, in fact, be a reflection of the hard times that honeybees have fallen upon. Hmm. Bumblebees are also pretty good at handling a wide range of flowers, but nobody beats the honeybee. The honeybee, sometimes beekeepers or the people in the pollination world call it a pollen pig, because it's not only is it good at handling different kinds of flowers, but because it has this sophisticated communication system, it can exploit these, you know, short-lived flowers very efficiently. Because one bee will come back from a foray and tell its nestmates exactly where to go. You know, turn left at the lilacs, make a, you know, go past them, and they can find these short-lived populations and use them very efficiently. Yeah, but we've got lots of native bees. They just tend to be sort of much more specific about which flowers they visit.
Right. We're a bit past the midpoint here. Mae Barenbaum is our guest. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. She's a specialist in studying insects. Every once in a while, she's here on the program. We talk about them, not how to get rid of them, but how to appreciate them. And if you have questions, please call. We have a couple of people ready to go. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Normal, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My daughter and I last fall collected the swallowtail caterpillar, and it cocooned, and we've been holding it all year in my dining room. And do you think it will come out of its cocoon?
Well, it's
is it too early yet?
Certainly not out of it. Was this the black swallowtail? Did you find it on like wild carrot or Queen Anne's lace?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we had fennel.
And, oh, yeah, they love fennel.
Yeah.
And is it brown or is it green, the chrysalis?
It's brown.
Brown. Well, that's a good sign. So odds are very good if it hasn't... how to say this delicately, it hasn't rotted by now. It very likely will come out. It's a little late for swallowtails to be emerging, but then again, it hasn't had the photoperiod cues living in your dining room, I guess, where you've kept it. It hasn't gone through this typical lowering and raising temperature cycle and light cycle. But if it's still firm and it doesn't feel like it's empty or light, then it's probably still in there.
Okay. And, I haven't touched it to see whether it was.
Yeah, we actually, the black swallowtail is, some people often ask me, do I have a favorite insect? And if I had to pick one, that would likely be way up on the list, because we're very interested in its eating habits, because it's very, very particular. It feeds only on plants in the carrot family, including fennel, which it really likes. And some of these plants in the carrot family are actually pretty poisonous, like poison hemlock is a relative of Queen Anne's lace. Doesn't bother these caterpillars. And they're very attractive and endearing with their little, they have a little gland that pops out behind their head, and it smells like rancid butter, and they'll threaten you with it if you try to eat them again. Not a good idea to eat colorful insects. So
if we do this again, should we leave it out?
Well, if you leave it in like a garage or something where it can get chilled and then warmed. I asked about the color because there's actually two different phases of pupal phases. In the summer, when the early generation of the black swallowtails pupates, they can be either brown or green. If they're green, and that depends on their background. If they pupate in sort of leaf litter that's kind of brownish, they'll be brown. And if they pupate on a stem of a wild carrot plant, they'll be green. The green pupae will come out after a week or 2 weeks at most. They don't have this ability to withstand the winter. Only the brown pupae can withstand the winter. Uh-huh. So you have an overwintering pupa, which is good. So it's one of the, you know, sort of endurance types. It's still likely to be viable.
So when should I expect it, or how long?
It should be pretty soon, because this is the time when the so-called first brood swallowtails should be flying. So first generation should be out any day now.
Okay. Well, I'll keep watching.
I hope good luck.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I was reading in Nature Conservancy that they'd put out a beetle in South Dakota for that evasive weed you were talking about. And I was wondering, maybe could they move that far?
Oh, from South Dakota?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are some folks here at University of Illinois who've been working with some entomologists in Switzerland to try to identify beetles to bring over for garlic mustard. So we might get our own imported shipment from Europe, depending on permits and permissions and the like. I know there's a whole lot of interest in getting something over from Europe that won't spread to other plants, but will knock back the garlic mustard. Whether something can get on its own here from South Dakota, not out of the realm of possibility. Going back to this poison hemlock, this is this noxious invasive weed that here in central Illinois is now attacked by a caterpillar that rolls the leaves into little tight tubes. And in fact, it didn't even have a common name until recently. It's the poison hemlock defoliating moth, not exactly trippingly on the tongue. And this is a caterpillar that found its way over here on its own. It wasn't deliberately introduced from Europe. It showed up in upstate New York in 1973. It turned up in California in 1980. On its own. It showed up in, there was an adult collected in 1984 in Ohio, and then in 1994 it showed up here in central Illinois. So nobody knows exactly how it gets around. It's about a quarter of an inch long, or a little bit longer than that, maybe half an inch long. So it's not probably flying on its own coast to coast, but it's managed to colonize pretty quickly.
Wow, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call.
Probably more than you wanted to know.
Just for the record, as they say on the CBC, in answer to this question, why would anybody bring poison hemlock? It apparently has medicinal uses.
Yeah, well.
Or at least in less than poison, lethal doses. it's used as a sedative and antispasmodic.
And the caller who mentioned it as an ornamental plant, too. There is that. It has ferny foliage that conceivably could be used in flower arranging and the like. Yeah.
It's poisonous. And yeah. You gotta say. Well, interestingly enough, though, apparently it has been believed to be or has been used as an antidote to strychnine poisoning and other similar poisons. And according to this little article I'm looking at here, in the Middle Ages, it was mixed with some other things and was considered to be a cure for the bite of a mad dog.
Ah, well, that does not constitute an endorsement here. I'm not sure that...
No. And apparently it's also been applied to kids who were teething. Huh. Apparently it's good for that, too.
Well, it is a neurotoxin, so it very well might... if it's a sedative, it could act to be a painkiller too. But I wouldn't recommend it.
No, we're not recommending. I'm just saying that's you know, it
people
has
do
been,
on
has
occasion die from that, eating that, poison hemlock.
And some of the websites here, I've turned up quite a few of them, and some of them are to address the concerns that vets or people like that would have, because also animals end up getting poisoned too. But yeah, so don't go out and eat that. If you find it. Let's see. Where are we going here? We're going to Champagne, line number three. Hello.
Yes, I am wondering whether there is any real relationship between ants and peonies.
Oh, yeah. It's that time of year. Peonies have what are called nectaries, extra floral nectaries. Extra means outside, floral, outside the flower. So these are little pockets of tissues, plant tissue that secrete sugary substances. And reason that plants have these extra floral nectaries, it's thought, is purely to attract ants. Why would you attract an ant if you were a plant? Well, there was a long controversy for decades about whether, there's a famous ant expert in the 1910 basically said plants have no more need for their ants than dogs have of their fleas. But around 1966, a guy named Dan Jansen was convinced this could not just be a casual association and demonstrated that one particular type of plant that has not only nectaries but provides a little structure for ants to build their nests in actually benefit from being associated with ants, because the ants are what are called pugnacious defenders. They're hooked on sugar. They're very devoted to their food source. So they will patrol the plants and in the course of their patrolling get rid of any plant feeding insects that might pose a risk to that plant. Whether this is out of a sense of loyalty or whether they don't mind a little protein snack every now and then, it depends on the ant species. But there's certainly ample evidence that plants that have nectaries can benefit from the fact that ants are frantically crawling all over them trying to gather up as much sugar as they can. And ants and peonies, they go together like, I don't know, like a horse and carrot. I don't know the words to that song. But
peanut
anyway,
butter and jelly?
Peanut butter and jelly. But yeah, so it's like a rite of spring where the peonies, right before those flowers open, you'll see the ants swarming all over. What they're doing is lapping up extra floral nectar secretions.
Okay. Well, then, there's something real going on there.
Now, peonies are not native, and some of the ants, in fact, aren't native. So this might not be one of the really complex mutualistic associations. But even a casual association with ants can benefit plants mm-hmm. in terms of keeping other insects off.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. And let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question that kind of goes to this plant and insect relationship. And that is, which came first, the plant or the insect or the animal? I'd be more general about it. Obviously, when you get down to the level of bacteria and stuff, it all breaks down. But which came first?
Well, that you'd have to go to the fossil record, and it doesn't get that easy even looking at the fossil record, because what happened around, between 300 and 400 years ago is that terrestrial habitats became available. So everything used to be kind of a big soup.
You mean 300 or 400 million years
did
ago?
Did I say 300?
Yeah.
What did I say? 300 or 400 million years ago. Yes, not back in... right. No, 300 to 400 million years ago, terrestrial environments were available for colonization. And among the very first colonists of dry land were plants and insects. Now, the vast majority of insects and plants today that we see in terrestrial environments are descendants of those early colonists. In fact, early colonists probably didn't have a lot to do with each other. But at the beginning of the Cretaceous era, there was a simultaneous explosion in one particular group of plants, the flowering plants, the angiosperms, and in the so-called higher insects, beetles and the butterflies and moths, and the two groups that are associated most closely with flowering plants. And this was, again, it was kind of a simultaneous explosion of species. And you can get arguments back and forth about whether the actual increase in the number of families of these higher insects occurred before the flowering plants by a few million, by a couple of hundred million years or tens of millions of years. People debate, but who exactly was here first is hard to pinpoint. But it's clear that this interaction fostered a lot of diversification. So they neither would be where they are today without the other. Even though there's insects inflict a lot of damage to plants, by the same token, there are lots of plants who depend on insects for pollination, and also some plants that depend on insects for dispersing their seeds. So it really is kind of a partnership.
So in other words, nobody's really sure.
Oh, there are careers that rise and fall based on
that question,
yeah.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
All right, thank you for the call. One of the things I'm sure that we have talked about before is the multicolor Asian lady beetle. And one of the things that I learned fairly recently, I guess from talking to Phil, was that this was, and you set me straight if I'm not remembering it right, this was something that was deliberately introduced. It was brought from China as a natural control to try to control, was it aphids?
Pecan aphids. Tree-living aphids.
They brought it. They have these aphids that attacked pecans in Georgia, I guess. And of course, there again, they want to get rid of the insects that attack the pecans. So someone said, well, you know, there's this beetle. We can bring it over here. And I guess that they really didn't quite understand how robust it would be and its ability to spread, which gets me thinking about this idea of introducing the insect to control the garlic mustard and how it is that you ever really know, because there were so many examples of people introducing some kind of species, thinking that it would be a good idea, and it turned out not to be a good idea. They become very invasive. They outcompete native species. Often there are no natural predators of that thing, so then it just goes nuts. And how do you ever know if you're going to introduce something from another kind of ecosystem into one where it's never been before? How do you ever really know what the long-term effect might be?
Well, the answer is you don't. But the rest of the answer is biological control is a different discipline from what it was 20, 30 years ago. And there are, you know, if nothing else, we've learned from the past. And in the past, you could do just about anything. People would bring in fact, it was considered, there's a tachinid fly, a parasitic fly that was brought in to control gypsy moths. And this was a fly that had hundreds of other hosts. It would attack hundreds of other Lepidoptera. But in the early part of the 20th century, that was thought to be a plus because gypsy moths have only one generation a year. They figured it'll live on something else the rest of the season. Well, it certainly did. And in fact, this particular fly has been implicated in the decline of the giant silk moths, the Saturnias, like Cecropia moth and Luna moths, and because among the many hundreds of other Lepidoptera it attacks are those species. But today, to bring something in, there is a very strict regimen of host specificity tests that have to be done. You have there's a long and elaborate protocol that requires, you know, peer review and approval before you can bring anything in. And so the field has changed enormously. And species that there's no way, for example, multicolored Asian ladybugs would ever have been brought over and used in biocontrol today because of the breadth of their diet. Generally, if something eats a whole lot of different things, you don't want to bring it over because those are the real biocontrol nightmares. And the worst of all, not the insects or the vertebrates. So you probably heard about cane toads, for example, just taking over Australia. They were brought in to control some beetle grubs that live in sugarcane fields. And turns out they didn't even go into sugarcane fields to eat the beetle grubs. It was too easy to eat all everything else around. So now cane toads are a big problem in Australia. Brown tree snakes in Guam, all kinds of vertebrates, goats on Catalina Islands. It's just vertebrates tend to be a lot more Catholic in their tastes than insects. So it's a whole different enterprise than it was.
Mm. Well, how are we doing? Because we've also had introductions that were accidental, like the longhorn beetle that was causing such problem in trees in the Chicago area, for example. I'm sure there are a lot of others or the Asian, like the Asian tiger mosquito, that those things, and I'm sure that there are others that came by accident. How are we doing on making sure that stuff like that doesn't continue to happen?
Well, AFIS is the Animal and Plant Health Identification Service, is that responsible for our borders, and they are woefully understaffed. It's just a monumental enterprise undertaking, and you have to layer onto that now. There's been a general elevation and awareness that not only can there be accidental introductions, but there can also be deliberate introductions under the what would be considered agricultural bioterrorism. So this was a there's a long history of at least accusations of ag bioterrorism going all the way back to when the Germans in World War II accused Americans of deliberately introducing Colorado potato beetles into German potato fields to demoralize the Germans. Our Defense Department denied it, but who knows the value of a denial from our Defense Department. The Japanese, during World War II, developed plans to drop plague-infected fleas on parts of China. So not only do we have to contend with highly regulated biocontrol introductions potentially going awry, but also accidental introductions, which are increasing astronomically because of the globalization of trade. And now this new idea of ag bioterrorism. And ag bioterrorism doesn't result in people starving to death, but it does result in the collapse of markets and sort of economic chaos. Presence of Mediterranean fruit fly, which is an invasive species that feeds on some 300 different fruits of economic importance, will shut our markets down. We can't export fruits if we're shown to have medflies. So it wouldn't take much there if anybody can get to sleep tonight thinking about that.
On that cheerful note, we got to end. May Barenbaum is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She'll be back again another day, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Oh, always a pleasure.